the center point in this geometry of meaning is to understand why it is that science is spiritual. Or to put it the other way around, why the spirit is scientific. It's not like two sides of the same coin, but it's like science is the spirit functioning. The spirit is the participator in science. And the primordial transformation is twofold. In the first place, in a naive way, we are an unconscious element, as it were, in the natural flow. The radical transformation comes with the achievement of an inner integration, characterized by the capacity to become an observer of nature and not just an element in the natural pattern. Sometimes succinctly phrased, we gain the capacity to abstract ourselves from what's going on and to see it dispassionately, so that the radical change is from an element to an observer, from being just another part of what's going on to being an observer who has the capacity to abstract themselves from the process. So the first radical shift is from part to observer. The second radical shift is from observer to participator. Now, the first shift is characterized by the ability to symbolize. The difference between someone who is just a part of things and someone who can observe quite accurately what's going on is the capacity, summed up in the capacity, to symbolize. The second shift from observer to participator is the radical change that happens in science when its spiritual activity is realized. In other words, one doesn't become a participator immediately in science. It takes a while. It takes a refinement to understand that one is no longer an observer, that what you are affects exactly everything that happens, so that you have to reconsider yourself is not just a dispassionate observer, but as an actual integral part of what you are observing, and thus reflexively becoming a participator. So that in a way, there's kind of like a V, or if you want to invert it, it's like a Platonic lambda, the old Pythagorean sequencing. We start as a part, we gain an abstract observer status, and then we come back as a participator. We come back as a conscious part. But that conscious part is able to participate in the whole, not just in its role as a part, but in the gestalt of the whole. And so we become a whole part, if I can use that kind of term. That's where the science is. So that nature transforms once into the self and a second time into what do we call the all on that scale? We call it the cosmos because the Greek word has come down to us in the English language. And we still use the Greek term for that. So that nature becomes a cosmos through the intermediary of the human self. Without the attainment of the human self, there is no cosmos. A cosmos is nature conscious, alive as a whole. So that man's self-attainment is the trigger by which nature becomes cosmic. So that if we use the colloquial term that was popularized in the Renaissance some 500 years ago, cosmic man, that's an epithet, that's a label for the purpose function which we fulfill in the ecology of the real. In other words, it's not just a static label, cosmic man. But the label has meaning. It means that's what our purpose is in the functioning of the real. Note here that we cannot expect to leap over the self. We cannot expect to go from nature to science. Most of what happens today that is called science is a naive surrogate, a parallel, and what functions where the self should be in its rightful place is a kind of an inflated egotism which translates its value, its purpose, its meaning, generally into terms of power and money and position. Why are you doing these experiments? Because we need to have these experiments to get further grants to do more experiments. We can't become full-fledged professors unless we have so many hours of lab stuff and so many publications. We're not going to get a raise if we don't produce something, so we're doing these experiments to produce something so we can get a raise. I'm putting it in the brash, cold language that private thoughts usually come up. If you're not familiar with the world of power, politics, science. This may seem strange to you, but it's exactly as I described. It's even worse than the caricature that I'm making. The upshot of this is that the inflated ego finds a deep, almost archetypal suspicion verging on hatred for their inner selves. Because the ultimate threat to an inflated ego of achieving its power, its position, its money, is sabotage from the inside. The inflated ego has no problem in targeting people that they need to undermine, in making up enemy lists. But the inner self of that person is the most feared enemy. And this is why whenever anyone really good, in just the colloquial sense, comes along, they're treated as naive, and that this kind of naivete can get us all killed, and let's get them fired or moved out, and the scapegoat mechanism comes into play. Dostoevsky in The Idiot shows us in Prince Mishkin the archetypal way in which this scenario always plays itself out. D.H. Lawrence in The Man Who Died shows us the twist when the victim refuses to cooperate. And between Dostoevsky and D.H. Lawrence, you can find a very, very good understanding of this. There's also a great volume in Sir James George Frazer's The Golden Bough called The Scapegoat. This phenomenon is the preferred scenario by which the inflated ego protects itself from its own inner competition. And of course, the inflated ego never would believe that its own inner self is the enemy. There's always a projection. It's always, oh no, it's really that person. It's really that idea. Nowhere does this come to the fore more than in science. So that nowhere is there more of a chance for cosmic man to be a Frankenstein. Frankenstein is the perfect archetypal image of the inflated ego, which maintains itself by a kind of a selective pastiche, trying to take the best from a whole variety of places and incorporate it into itself. Really successful people in the game of power and position, money is secondary. It's power and position that are really what you want. And the archetypal way is to identify characteristics of successful people and imitate and take those characteristics and put together your own personality, as it were, your own ego, by assembling all your favorite things, whether or not they're consistent with your own history, your own development, your own real personality or not. In a way, the comic book villain, the Joker in Batman, is the perfect example of the person who is not themselves, but is a pastiche of all the clevernesses from all the people that one has met. So that one is not a person in the regular order of society, but is the joker in the deck, the wild card, the fool turned clever and vicious. So that science is the exact place where this danger is paramount. And in fact, the whole development of the symbolic image of Frankenstein was due to the genius, not just of Mary Shelley, but of her husband, the great poet Percy Shelley, and his friend, the great poet Lord Byron. And it was in long conversations in Italy between Shelley and Byron, with a number of their entourage around, that they came to realize 200 years ago that the real boogeyman in the universe is scientific man who was not mature, who didn't mature from the inside out, but who sought to make his maturation on the basis of selective cleverness from the outside in. And of course, this is one of the great images of all time. In a way, the image, the symbolic image of Frankenstein is a scientific mythic figure, or a mythic figure in the science level of development, which is parallel to the Satan or the devil in traditional mythologies. That is to say, the Satan, and I'm using the article "the" there because in the most accurate assessment of this, the ancient Jewish mind assessed the Satan as a neuter, neither male nor female. A very accurate assessment. And so, and one finds it in the book of Job. The book of Job is the most exacting presentation. The Satan. There's always this neuter article in Hebrew that prefaces. So that what you're dealing with here is not a negative human being, but a neutral human being for whom no human values whatsoever work or occur or influence. So that the Satan is the archetypal adversary of man. How does the archetypal adversary of man function? By trying to neuter and dissolve all human values, no matter what they are, by absorbing the values of this person or that person into the neutral. Now notice that the neutrality, the neuterness of the Satan is the inflated ego's version of the deep self's abstracted equanimity. So that the Satan is not the shadow of man, but the shadow of God. And one of the great lessons in the book of Job, Job realizes that he's not dealing with his evil, if I may be permitted to say, he's dealing with God's evil. And that's when he realizes that he's outclassed. That's when he shuts up. That's when he realizes that the scale on which he may plead his case is exceeded. The level upon which his language of rightness and justice operates is dwarfed by the enormity of the adversary. It is God's shadow and not his. In the beginning of the book of Job, God asks, when the Satan says, here I am. And right away, God says, where have you come from? And the Satan replies, from roaming to and fro on the earth. Has come from an outside, an exterior realm, and not from the inside. Now you can see that the Frankenstein is the scientific mythic image of this, is perfect. The whole Hollywood notion of Bride of Frankenstein is completely misunderstanding what Shelley and Byron had come to see. That's like Cecil B. DeMille, Boris Karloff. It has no bearing. The original Frankenstein is a neutered Superman. This is the threat, because the lure of that is indistinguishable from someone who has mastered themselves in terms of the mediocre everyday human personality. The mediocre everyday human personality cannot tell the difference between a yogi and a Frankenstein. Is unable to differentiate. The mass mind cannot tell the difference between a savior and a demagogue. Has no idea. But because of the natural egotistic defenses, tends to favor the demagogue over the savior. In a subconscious way, feels the threat which a savior brings and feels the kind of security which a demagogue brings. So left to themselves, the mass mind will always kill the savior and will always follow in emulation the demagogue. Notice the precariousness of human development on this at this stage and on this scale. That one cannot leave the situation alone. To leave the situation alone is to invite an inevitable failure and catastrophe. One cannot leave it alone. So that there is here, more than anywhere else in human development, the realization of an ethical import to our actions. Not a moral import. It's not on the basis of what's right or wrong, but an ethical import on what is necessary. One's decision is not based on right and wrong, but on what is really necessary in terms of the real. In a moral decision, this scale of complexity would produce limbo. You would realize that the complexity is too much for you in your capacity to judge. And you would decide, as the archetype is, and incidentally the archetype of this whole thing appears in Aeschylus's great Orestia, the trilogy. It ends in a hung jury. I have to emphasize to you, it always ends in a hung jury. Because of the complexity, there's no way for you to decide which way to go in terms of morality. That's why one has to shift over to an ethic away from a moral code. Notice that a morality is ostensibly a code, is a kind of a law system, is a legality which has a cultural basis. Morality, mores, are cultural phenomena. They are sociological phenomena. But an ethic is a human phenomenon. It's not a sociological phenomenon. It's a psychological phenomenon. It's different. Only an individual is able to make an ethical decision. The group cannot make that decision. The culture cannot foster that decision. An ethical decision is based upon the ability of an individual to make that assessment, to make those moves, to live by that. But the only way that an individual can do this is if they have matured as a person. And now we're getting to the arcane relationship between art and science. It's only when you have mastered the art of person making, your person, that you have any chance at all of really doing science right. Of really having an ethic of reality operate in your science. In other words, science is spiritual or it is a dangerous web entrapping the unsuspecting and supporting the inflated egos. Now you can see that when one assesses the world in this way, that we have walked into a rather precarious situation. You can understand the high level of despair in our lifetimes in this world. Although many people could not express, like I'm expressing this morning to you, just what it is that bothers them, almost everyone who is somewhat sensitive and intelligent knows and will say quite openly, they're a little disturbed about things. It seems like an anxious time. Why don't things work? What's wrong with the world? Well, you can see that what's wrong is not the result of just accident, but is part of a design which is projected out because of the pattern of transformation. The very structure of the way in which transformation really works engenders this impasse. To put it succinctly, science brings the possibility of heaven or hell. And increasingly, as the capacity for handling power goes up, there's less and less middle ground. Until finally, there's just a clear-cut dichotomy, paradise or oblivion, is probably a better way to put it. Which is why the projected archetypal vision of this was always Armageddon or Utopia. Those were the mythic image qualities that were always associated with human development when the interior self is able to generate its effectiveness historically and begin to develop a science. And always these two apocalyptic images. Notice that a utopia is also an apocalyptic image. Armageddon or utopia become the only two viable paths eventually. So that the classic phrase is that this is the razor's edge. All of your middle ground options have shrunk to a razor edge, a razor sharpness. In fact, even the colloquial sense is that even to try and maintain a middle ground becomes painful. It's like trying to stand on the razor's edge because you can't decide which way to go. Now you would say, well, of course everyone would choose utopia rather than Armageddon, but the deception of the worldly ego does not permit you to distinguish which is which. One of the best ways that this particular conundrum is expressed is the phenomenon of the con man. Thomas Mann's great novel, Felix Krull, Con Man, or Herman Melville's The Confidence Man, or Dostoevsky's The Gambler. The whole phenomenon is that one cannot tell who is ultimately trustworthy. The only way that you can tell is if you yourself are trustworthy. If you have developed your own self, if you've brought your own self out, you can immediately see who is trustworthy and who is not. You can immediately see who is the Satan and who is the Savior. It's an instantaneous recognition because one is seeing from the single eye of the heart, as it were. And you can see who is to be trusted. And that seeing is the Greek term for that was theoria. theoria, which didn't mean theory like in speculation, but meant contemplation. In other words, meditation is holding the attention within, and contemplation is sending that attention out. And in a contemplative mode, when you send your concentration out, as soon as it touches someone who is legitimate, they shine. It's just like a laser lighting up a target. They shine, and you can see this person is really there. You could trust your life with this person. Or on the other hand, this person is unconscious. Watch out. More or less, watch out. Now, usually it's on a level where it's naive, and it really wouldn't make much difference to your existential pattern. It's only rarely that you find someone who is really devolved into that Frankenstein-like quality. And even then, the average person, if we can say this, has subconscious hackles. There's something weird about this person. Like the Night Stalker, if you followed that trial at all, there's something eerily wicked about the person. It wasn't the man, it was something in the man. Later on, one of the ways that you can tell is because someone who is spiritually awakened, their spirit, their body is expressive of their spirit. Whereas someone who has devolved, their body is a tool of some kind of inner cleverness. There's a discrepancy between the inner and the outer. It's like you can demonstrate it to yourself. When you pick up a baby, you can feel how that baby is just exactly what that baby is. That baby's body is exactly what that baby is. And there's kind of like a mellow sweetness, if you're sensitive to it at all. Whereas there's sometimes you can touch someone, an adult, and you can just feel something's wrong here. It's in the hand, you can tell. All of this is not just a preface, but is a kind of focusing now so that you can understand why science is spiritual. It isn't just an idea that science is spiritual. It's the actuality. Now look here for a second. If this is the case, if this is what we are doing here now on Saturday morning, what more important area of inquiry is there? And the answer is none. There is no area of inquiry that conscientious human beings can examine more important than this. Now you can look around you and you can see how many people are not doing this. It's not reflexive just simply on them, but it's indicative of the time in which we live. I tell you truly, we live in a junkyard. We live in an ethical nightmare. And if there were ever any proof that God is compassionate, it's that he allows man to continue to be even under these conditions. It's unbelievable. Now we're coming to science. And notice that when we're coming to science, we're understanding now that the scientific endeavor is a spiritual activity. So that on one level, everything that we're now going to talk about is scientific. On a deeper level, it's metaphorical for a spiritual process. This comparative relationality between these initial two realms is allegorical. Science, on the first level of deeper consciousness, becomes allegorical. If you codify, if you freeze the allegory into a pattern, that frozen pattern of the allegory is called a paradigm. So that science is paradigmatic of a spiritual process. It goes farther than that, but that's as far as we'll take it today. So now let's come to one of our textbooks, which you may or may not have. I imagine none of you have. The Molecular Biology of the Cell. Wherever you would go on this planet today, this would be one of the textbooks used in universities. If you were taking the course in Nigeria, or you're taking the course in India, or taking the course in England, or here, or Japan, or wherever, this would be the text, or there are a couple now, since this came out 4 years ago, that are similar to this. This is indicative of the planetary culture which is evolving in the scientific endeavor. The origin of the molecular biology of the cell is the double helix. And the double helix was one of our texts back at the very beginning of the course in Nature. Watson, James Watson, who was the author of the double helix, is the central author in the molecular biology of the cell. So that this book is 30 years after the first book. The double helix was the development of the symbol of understanding the symbolic structure, and the molecular biology of the cell is the scientific development from that symbol put into operation as an idea. Now you can see how powerful. The double helix, in essence, was like a single mandala. The whole achievement in the double helix went almost no further than the fact of getting the picture straight. What is the symbolic structure of life? And the molecular biology of the cell is, in fact, the first time that that symbol is expanded to include the basic form within which life occurs, the cell. The eukaryotic cell is the basic form within which all life occurs. That is to say, this is a symbol, the double helix, and the cell is a life expression of that symbol in operation. The double helix is a symbol in the self. The cell is a scientific actuality of life radiated out from that self. So that the double helix is not just a diagrammatic figure, but is indeed a spiritual symbol. In fact, it's the archetypal hermetic symbol. The double helix is the archetypal hermetic symbol. Familiar to you in its one way, but if you turn it vertically, you can see the double helix. The hermetic caduceus with the two serpents wrapped around the caduceus is the double helix. If one links together the hermetic infinity signs this way, you have a golden chain. In Renaissance occultism, it was called Homer's golden chain. If you turn it the other way, and you have a series of infinity signs this way, this is the ancient Egyptian symbol for living time. And where the pharaoh would be is on the moving edge of this living time. But of course, the hermetic understanding was that every matured being is on the moving edge of living time. The ancient hermetic understanding in archaic Egypt, even 5,000 years ago, already was understood. You are eternal in the sense that you are on the moving edge of time. And you are eternal because as time moves, you move with it. You're not consumed by time. As time happens in this universe, you go into the unknown and open it up. Time is like the rocket engine behind you that brings you into the cosmos. That position is a little esoteric. That position in the cell is taken by the membrane, so that the membrane is the interface in the cell. And in a very real way, man is a membrane in the cosmos. His personality is a membrane. And we know now that the health of a cell depends upon its membrane being permeable to processes. If a membrane in a cell stops processes from going from within to without and from without to within, stops processes, if the membrane becomes opaque, the cell dies. It is the permeability of the membrane that allows for life to occur. How does the permeability work in a cell? We know now that it is through ionic channels. All cell membranes have ionic channels in them. Not little trap doors, but sensitive areas where the ionic charge can go through. Transformational windows, as you were. And just so the human personality to be viable has to allow the energies of the self to go through the membrane of the personality and become spiritual energy. And the only way that life can occur at all, period, at all, period, is for man to do this. If man does not do this, nature still occurs, but there is no cosmos. So when you talk about the ethical responsibility of man, his responsibility, which he cannot shirk, is that he is the key for conscious life to be. It's staggering when you have a self-deprecating image of oneself and you hope to hell that some God is going to save you, and you realize that you're the important part. Kazantzakis, in his Cretan way, in The Saviors of God, outlines it very bluntly. God needs to be saved, and man better get busy. There's a lot to do. It's that kind of a thing. Now, the development of membranes is so important that I selected out four volumes from the literature, contemporary literature. And if you get interested, this little paperback from Cambridge University Press, The Lively Membranes, is available, and I think it's about $11, published in 1983, and it's a very good general introduction to membranes. If you have the bucks, Membrane Processes, Molecular Biology and Medical Applications, published in 1985, I believe, 84, carries it into the medical realm. And if you're interested in the viability, I'll wait. Go ahead.